You know that old joke, right? If you have to ask how much a Hermes Birkin costs, you probably can't afford one. It always gets a chuckle, but honestly, it does capture that extreme luxury, the almost mythical status of these bags. Today, though, we're not just here to say, yep, they're expensive. We're actually doing a deep dive. We want to get into the fascinating, sometimes really mind-boggling world of Hermes Birkin and Kelly bags. Our mission really is to get past just the price tag. We want to understand why. Why do they command these staggering sums? And, you know, explore their surprising history. Maybe uncover some stories behind the most exclusive ones out there. It's a journey that kind of challenges how we think about value and luxury.
It's really fascinating, isn't it? How essentially a leather accessory becomes this cultural icon. It's more than a bag. It's art. It's a financial asset sometimes. What we're looking at here is this unique mix of incredible artistry, a really rich heritage going back centuries, and market dynamics that are frankly unlike almost anything else. We'll try to connect those dots for you, show how all these things turn a handbag into something potentially worth millions.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. What actually drives the price of a Hermes bag?
Yeah.
We know it depends a lot on the model, the size, the material of, you know, calfskin versus exotic skins and condition, obviously. Even the, let's say, popular or entry-level Birkins or Kellys, they can easily run you, what, $10,000 to $20,000 direct from Hermes. But the real showstoppers, the ones that make headlines, they hit six, sometimes even seven figures. So looking at our sources, there seem to be these core pillars explaining these prices. What's the first one that really jumps out?
Well, for anyone who knows Hermes, the first thing is craftsmanship. No. And it's more than just quality. It's almost like a religion for them. These aren't just assembled. They're true masterpieces, hand-stitched, usually by one single artisan from beginning to end. They use the absolute finest materials, often incredibly rare ones like Perosus crocodile, you know, prized for its perfect scales, the amount of care, the sheer skill involved. It leads to this incredible durability, yes, but also this flawless finish. It's almost perfect. It's that human touch, you know, an individual artisan's dedication.
So it's not just the expensive leather, it's the actual person behind it. That single artisan's skill becomes part of the bag's story, almost like an artist signing their painting.
Absolutely. Each one is essentially unique because of that, a testament to that person's skill. Then the second pillar has to be timelessness. Hermes bags, they don't really chase fleeting trends. Their design it's rooted in the sophisticated, elegant minimalism. They're evergreen. The shapes, the clean lines, they just work. Formal event, casual lunch, doesn't really matter. They don't go out of style.
That's impressive, avoiding the trend cycle. But does that make them seem maybe a bit conservative?
Right.
Or is that the whole point? That immunity to the fashion cycle gives them an edge.
That's precisely the strategy, I think. By staying above trends, they cultivate this lasting desire. It doesn't feel dated. Which leads us to the third point, exclusivity. And with Hermes, this isn't just about making fewer bags. No, it's a masterclass in controlling access. They are absolutely not mass-produced. Demand consistently, dramatically outstrips supply. It's a very deliberate, engineered scarcity. They create this weightless culture, this feeling of having to qualify for a bag. For many people, that chase is part of the luxury experience itself. It shifts the power, really.
Engineered scarcity.
Hmm.
That's a great way to put it. The hunt becomes part of the allure. And speaking of allure, there's no denying our Hermes bag is a major status symbol, right? It signals more than just money. It signals taste, connections, access. You see them on countless celebrities, Victoria Beckham, the Kardashians, Jamie Chua. It just cements their legendary status in pop culture.
Right. And it makes you wonder, in an age where sometimes overt luxury can be seen as, well, a bit much, how do they keep that aspirational glow? I think it's about that subtle recognition, a nod among those in the know. And finally, the fifth pillar. They are definitely seen as investment pieces. Because of that incredible quality and the extreme rarity, many Hermes bags hold their value or even increase year after year.
Yeah, we'll definitely circle back to that investment side later. It's clear these aren't just bags, they're assets.
Yeah.
Now, given all the value, the status, you might imagine Hermes starting out like, you know, some Grand Parisian couture house.
Yeah.
But the actual origin story is, well, it's surprisingly down to earth, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It begins not with high fashion, but with horses. Thierry Hermes. He was born back in 1801 in Krefeld, Germany. They called it the city of velvet and silk. He started out making leather goods, specifically harnesses, in a town in Normandy called Pont-Audemer. Very practical beginnings. Then in 1837, Thierry set up the House of Hermes in Paris. He opened a workshop, and pretty quickly he got this amazing reputation among European nobility for his harnesses and bridles. Top quality equestrian gear.
Right. So the focus was purely functional excellence at first. By the time he passed away, His son, Charles-Emile Hermès, took over, and he was the one who moved the main store to 24 Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré. That's still there today, which is incredible. That continuity is amazing. And the first Hermès bag, and it wasn't even for people, was it? It came much later, around 1900, the Haute à Couloir, designed specifically to carry horse saddles, a saddle bag, literally.
Exactly. It really grounds the brand's history. Then, under Emil Maurice, Charles-Emile's son, they landed the Russian Tsar as a client for saddles. Huge deal. And crucially, Hermès got the patent for the zipper in France. They were the first to use it. They famously put this Hermès fastener into leather golf jackets for the Prince of Wales around 1918. Clever stuff, but things were changing.
Yeah, the car was taking over. By the 1920s, harness sales were dropping. So, the story goes, Emil Maurice's wife, Julie, couldn't find a handbag she liked, so he designed one for her. In 1922, basically, a smaller version of that original saddle carrier, the Haute à Couloir. That was the real pivot, wasn't it? From horses to personal luxury.
A massive pivot. And it worked. Then, in 1935, they created another icon, the Sac à Depêche. And that bag became legendary in the 50s when Princess Grace Kelly used it to sort of shield her pregnancy from the paparazzi cameras. That photo went everywhere. Hermès eventually renamed it the Kelly Bag in her honor in the 70s.
What a story. And it's just amazing that the company has stayed family-owned through all of this, five generations. That speaks volumes about their commitment to quality, to heritage. It's more than a brand. It's like a dynasty.
Yeah.
Okay, so with that incredible history as context, let's get to the part I suspect many listeners are waiting for. Let's talk about some specific bags that have fetched these truly jaw-dropping prices. These are the icons.
Right. Let's start with one that's, well, entry level for this stratosphere.
Wait.
The Bettan Matt Perosis Crocodile Birkin 30 sold for $70,000 in 2022. It's this beautiful, chic, sort of concrete gray color with beige undertones made from that prized Perosis crocodile skin, gold hardware, released in 2018, became an instant classic, very sophisticated neutral.
$70,000 entry level.
Okay. Huh, relatively speaking. Then there's the Umbri Birkin. Sotheby's sold one for $137,500 in 2022. This one's usually lizard skin, often in the smaller 25-centimeter size. What's really unique is the pattern, the way the lizard skin creates this symmetrical, almost hypnotic pattern, even covering the lock and the little key fob, the clochette. It's a collector's piece. Interestingly, its price can fluctuate a bit. Sometimes you might find one for less. A bargain, in Hermès terms, if you're lucky.
$137,000 bargain. Got it.
Moving up again, the So Black Birkin fetched $208,000 back in 2019. This was designed by Jean-Paul Gaultier when he was creative director. It had this unique black PVD-coated hardware, completely monochrome. But here's the kicker. Hermès actually recalled them. They were worried the black coating wasn't durable enough. And that recall, ironically, made them super rare and boosted the price like crazy on the secondary market.
Wow, so a potential flaw actually made it more valuable. Only in the world of Hermès, maybe.
Seems like it. Then you have the Faubourg Birkin. Prices range from around $305,000 up to $400,000. These are super popular limited editions, only 50 made of some versions. The design is amazing. It actually looks like the storefront of the Paris boutique on Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré. Uses different leathers like Togo and Matte Alligator. Collectors call it a trophy piece, like owning a mini architectural model you can carry.
That's incredible artistry, a building on a bag.
Now we get into a really rarefied category. The Diamond Himalaya Birkin. These can go up to $500,000, $500,000. Himalaya isn't the origin, it refers to the color. It's Nilotacus crocodile dyed in this delicate white and gray gradient like the snowy mountains. It's considered the absolute pinnacle of crocodile skin. And of course, they have 18 karat white gold hardware studded with diamonds, true collector's items. There's that famous story about Vegas Dave Onsea. He paid $500,000 for a 25 centimeter Himalaya in 2019. Apparently, he knew he was overpaying. Its estimated value was maybe $350,000, but he wanted to break the record for the most expensive Birkin sold.
Yeah. He bought the record, not just the bag. That's something else. But even that isn't the absolute peak, is it? There are pieces that basically blur the line between handbag and high jewelry, the ultimate trio, I think you called it.
Exactly. These are almost, well, conceptual pieces. First, the Jinsa Tanaka crafted Hermès Birkin, valued at an astonishing $1.9 million. Designed by Japanese jeweler Jinsa Tanaka, the body is solid platinum, covered in 2,000 diamonds. And the craziest part, the diamond strap, featuring an 8-carat pear-shaped diamond, is detachable. You can wear it as a necklace or a bracelet. The bag then becomes a clutch.
So it's jewelry that holds things. Wow.
Then there's a set designed with the jeweler Pierre Hardy, the rose gold Hermès Kelly, the Hermès Chain d'Ancre, and the Sac Bijou Birkin, all around the $2 million mark each. The rose gold Kelly is solid rose gold set with 11,160 diamonds. It's designed to look like crocodile leather, which is amazing craftsmanship itself. Took 2 years to make each one. And it's tiny. You couldn't even fit sunglasses in it. It's meant to be worn like a bangle. Only 12 exist. Sold privately.
Privately sold. So even if you had the $2 million, you'd need the right connections. The exclusivity is on another level.
Completely. The Chain d'Ancre bag, also by Pierre Hardy, is part of their Haute Bijouterie collection. Intricate chain link design, also covered in 11,160 diamonds, about 34 carats worth. Again, more jewelry than bag. Only three ever made.
Only three.
And finally, the most expensive one listed, the Sac Bijou Birkin, also $2 million. This is a miniature but functional Birkin shape made of rose gold but inlaid with 2,712 diamonds. That's nearly 90 carats. Created in 2012, again by Pierre Hardy. Each one apparently took 1,200 to 1,600 hours of work. Only three are thought to exist. Again, sold privately. You don't see these on display anywhere. So if you connect all this back, these examples aren't just about shocking prices. They show this convergence of high art, meticulous engineering, and the absolute ultimate in exclusivity. They're not just fashion. They're unique historical objects.
It really drives home that investment point, too. It's not just talk. Studies keep showing Birkins as a, quote, extremely solid investment. Increasing in value, what, over 500% in 35 years? Outperforming gold, outperforming stocks. But practically speaking, how does that work? Is it like stocks? Are certain Birkins more blue chip than others? What about condition or resale?
That's a really good question for anyone seriously considering it. And yes, while the overall trend is positive, not all Birkins are equal investments. Limited editions, obviously. Rare leathers, especially that Himalaya crocodile. And condition is paramount. Pristine bags command huge premiums. Reputable auction houses like Christie's or Sotheby's and trusted high-end resellers are the main channels. But it's not instantly liquid like stocks. It takes time, patience, understanding that niche market. It's not for casual dipping in and out.
Right, it's a specialist market. And speaking of navigating markets, how does Hermès manage to maintain this position? Especially with global economic shifts, geopolitical issues, other luxury brands seem constantly reacting.
It raises that important question, doesn't it? How do they keep succeeding, especially now in 2025? Their strategy is incredibly measured. Almost counterintuitive sometimes. Yes, they have gradual price increases on most bags, though interestingly, not on the Birkin itself at the moment, according to sources. They do strategic collaborations, like with Apple. But the core is their distribution. It's almost impenetrable. Well, they rely heavily on building those long-term relationships in their stores, that allocation system. They don't chase e-commerce the way others do. It keeps demand perpetually higher than supply. It's a masterclass in sort of psychological pricing and making desirability the key. The scarcity is the value driver.
That insulated approach is fascinating. It makes you wonder how they handle global crises. Our sources touched on the impact of the war in Ukraine, for example, on luxury brands.
Exactly. When sanctions hit, many luxury brands, Hermès included, along with Chanel, LVMH, they closed stores in Russia, stopped shipments over a certain value. Hermès put out a statement, deeply concerned, temporarily closed their three Moscow stores. But here's the thing. The actual financial hit for Hermès wasn't huge. Russia's luxury market, maybe $9 billion a year, is tiny compared to the U.S., like $64 billion, or China, over $150 billion. So while it was a disruption, Hermès' global spread and their focus on ultra-high net worth clients meant their exposure was limited. It kind of highlights how their strategy shields them from regional shocks that might hit brands relying on broader market sales.
It's incredible how that deliberate scarcity and focus on a very specific global elite effectively buffers them. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've covered a lot today. From, you know, a humble harness maker in 1837 all the way to these multi-million dollar pieces of wearable art coveted worldwide. It's really about understanding all those layers, the history, the art that engineered scarcity, the market dynamics that define what true luxury means in this context.
Right. And maybe think beyond the diamonds and the price tags for a second. Consider how an object, any object, can transcend its basic function, how it can become a generational asset, a piece of cultural history, a testament to this enduring human drive for beauty and perfect craftsmanship. How does that make us think differently about the whole idea of value? It asks you to look deeper than the sticker price, into the legacy itself.
That is a powerful thought to end on. And for you listening, which part of the Hermès story resonates most? Is it the rich history, the incredible artistry, or maybe that surprising power as an investment, outperforming traditional markets? Something to think about until our next deep dive.